This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sure, it's a big deal that Lehman Brothers announced a nearly $3 billion quarterly loss today. And yeah, it matters that they needed an extra $6 billion to balance the books, but don't get distracted by those headlines, because the real story today is this. Those reports of the demise of the credit crunch, greatly exaggerated. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by Clarks and Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 9th of June today. Ever since Bear Stearns almost went under 3 months ago, the buzz has been about Lehman Brothers. Lehman's the smallest of Wall Street's big independent investment banks. Small in a business where small isn't always good. The only thing that's big are its losses. And as our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshea reports, that has gotten people talking.
Everyone's wondering if Lehman Brothers will be the next to disappear like Bear Stearns. Christopher Whalen is managing director at Institutional Risk Analytics.
The dealers like Bear Stearns and Lehman are an endangered species. It's very, very hard to imagine how they're going to survive in this illiquid and very volatile market.
Whalen worries that dealers don't have enough business lines to fall back on, like customer deposits, which give bigger banks access to lots of cash. Scott Sprinzen of Standard & Poor's cut the ratings of Lehman, Morgan Stanley, and Merrill Lynch last week. But he expects them all to survive, in part because the Federal Reserve is helping out. Sprinzen's more worried the investment business itself will slow. Fewer mergers, stock offerings.
You know, we would expect in the current environment that the consumer is going to be less interested in investing aggressively.
He says investors are putting their cash into things like money market funds, which are a lot less profitable for everyone. In New York, I'm Jill Barshea for Marketplace.
Oil lost $4 today, down to $134 or so a barrel. Part of that could have been the Saudi oil minister. He suggested a high-level get-together today between producers and consumers to talk about those rising prices. Gas went the other way, up to an all-time high average nationwide of $4.04 a gallon. That's 10%, about 40 cents, higher than it was just a month ago. The spike in prices is hurting corporate profits and fueling job layoffs. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports it's also making a big dent in volunteerism around this country.
Enid Borden is worried, very worried. She's president of the Meals on Wheels Association of America.
We are in a crisis situation now.
Volunteers for Meals on Wheels drive their own cars to deliver over 1 million meals a day to homebound seniors. These days, the meals and the wheels are more expensive. A recent survey showed at least 58% of the charity's local programs have lost volunteers due to high gas prices. Borden says many of those were seniors on fixed incomes themselves.
And so they realize that they have to make a decision for their own lives. Do I eat or do I go and volunteer and use that precious gasoline?
Borden says volunteer shortages have also meant cutting some delivery routes. She blamed two senior deaths on those cuts. Dennis Brady, a Meals on Wheels board member in Rockingham County, New Hampshire, says his local program is struggling to help its volunteer drivers.
We've tried to compensate them a little bit with gift cards for gasoline. We had a little bit of extra money left in our budget, and we felt that this was a good use for it.
$4 gas is hurting other nonprofits, too. Stephanie Spradling at Cox Health Hospitals in Springfield, Missouri, says they've lost three volunteers recently.
This was hard decisions for the volunteers to make because they don't work for paycheck. They work for the satisfaction of helping others.
The IRS does allow volunteers to deduct mileage on their tax returns, but that rate hasn't budged in years. The charity mileage rate is still 14 cents a mile. That compares to a business rate of about 50 cents. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Even though it means 4 or maybe 8 years of not having to fill up your own gas tank, sometimes you do have to wonder why anybody would actually want to be president. As if managing two wars isn't enough, whoever winds up in the Oval Office next January is still going to be facing a housing crisis. If he's lucky, gas is only going to be $4 a gallon. The economy will either be stuck in or have just avoided a recession. And the stock market, well, who knows about that? From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
As we head into summer, American voters are downright edgy about this economy.
All year long, we've seen economic attitudes as bad or worse as they've been in any recent election.
Carol Dougherty is at the Pew Center for People in the Press. He says the economy's number one on voters' minds.
In our most recent poll, 88% said it was very important to their vote.
And the choice is stark. Barack Obama wants to raise taxes on high-income Americans and cut the working class a break. John McCain believes tax cuts create growth. This afternoon in North Carolina, Obama argued that approach has been tried, and it failed.
The centerpiece of John McCain's economic plan amounts to a full-throated endorsement of George Bush's policies.
Dougherty at the Pew Center says right now, when it comes to improving the economy, more Americans trust Obama. He leads McCain on economic issues by 15 points.
You know, this is the ground that Obama wants to fight the election on.
But John McCain is pushing back. Today in Richmond, Virginia, he defended his proposal to suspend the gas tax, and the National Republican Party is releasing this ad.
After just 3 years in the Senate, Barack Obama demonstrates his poor grasp of basic economic principles. While families face tough times, his ideas to raise taxes are out of touch.
And both presidential candidates are traveling through swing states, hoping to convert anxiety about the economy into votes. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Wall Street tried to make a comeback today from Friday's losses, fizzled out at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shares of Apple struggled today. They hit the closing bell off a little more than 2%, and that was actually better than they'd been most of the day. You'd never know CEO Steve Jobs was in the process of rolling out the latest version of the iPhone. CNET writer Tom Krazit was in the audience up in San Francisco. Tom, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
So Steve Jobs takes the stage, the C's part, as they always do when he gets to one of these big expos and unveils the new product. And presto, we have a new iPhone, right?
Pretty much, yeah. In a couple of weeks, at least, July 11th, it'll be out.
What's the big deal about this phone that everybody's been waiting for?
Well, the main thing that everybody will instantly understand is its support for faster networks. It's going to run on what's called a third-generation mobile network, or 3G. And this is kind of like when you went from dial-up to broadband. It's you know, maybe not quite as fast as your home PC, but you can definitely notice a difference when you are doing something like downloading a web page or an attachment from your email.
Is this the thing that's going to let people finally get rid of having to carry an iPhone and a BlackBerry as well? Are you going to be able to do business applications on this?
It'll be able to do that. Whether your company will support it is another thing entirely, but this will have a lot of the features that IT people need in order to deploy a phone within, you know, a company's area. You know, things like support for Microsoft's ActiveSync technology, which basically regulates how email goes back and forth between your email servers at your company and your phone.
Yeah. Talk to me about price point. I'd love to have one of these things, but I don't have $400 to play around with.
Well, you don't need $400 anymore. The price was cut today. That was one big thing that was announced. The 8-gigabyte version will now cost $200, $199 to be specific. And the 16-gigabyte version will cost $299. This is for the new model that will be available on July 11th.
You keep saying July 11th. This thing's not ready to go yet.
Yeah, definitely the biggest surprise, I think, of today is the fact that it will not be available until July. And there's any number of reasons for that. We're going to have to look a little bit more into that. But, you know, I mean, that is a bit surprising. I don't know how much of an impact it will have. Apple has set themselves a goal of 10 million iPhone shipments in 2008. And it's kind of odd now because there will have been, you know, about a 6 to 8 week period where there were no iPhones available at all. So they're going to have to overcome that period where they didn't ship any.
What was the scene on the floor when Jobs came out and did this? Were there, hosannas and all that?
Yeah, it's a fan fest is really the way to put it. I mean, there were about 5,200 developers in attendance at this conference, which is actually a record. They said they sold out their allotment of developer slots. And, you know, these are people who run businesses on the Mac and now the iPhone. And you know, are pretty enthusiastic about new introductions that the company has to offer.
All that for a cell phone. Tom Krezit is a staff writer for CNETnews.com. We reached him up in San Francisco at the Moscone Center, where the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference is taking place. Tom, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
We're going to get the latest figures on international trade in the morning, which means we can reliably give you tomorrow's news today. Right after that report's released, we're going to hear a lot of grousing about the Chinese currency, the yuan. Last year, our trade gap with Beijing hit $256 billion. That's the biggest imbalance ever with a single country. American manufacturers say a weak yuan puts U.S. exports at a competitive disadvantage. But Bill Marcus reports from Shanghai, American workers figure if you can't beat them, join them.
Like many recent college graduates, Mark Meising's carrying an enormous debt burden. But his new job will allow him to pay off $28,000 in student loans and credit cards by the end of the summer. There's one catch, the jobs in China.
For me to grow my career path, tend to be much faster than in the U.S. I'm given a lot more responsibility out here with my current company, whereas in the U.S. I was hired as business associate.
Shanghai is teeming with American 20-somethings with 2 feet, a heartbeat, and a bachelor's degree. Those fluent in Chinese enjoy enormous earning power and opportunities unavailable in the U.S. recession.
Okay, so I explain the main course. It will be more easy for me. So we have
at this fancy French restaurant, 23-year-old Peter Braden's getting a rundown on a menu he couldn't even afford to look at back home in Ballston Spa, New York. But like the job market, prices in China are relative too.
A lot of my friends that are back home are kind of stagnating.
Peter's got his own apartment. He works as a writer, something he loves. If he were still home in upstate New York, he'd have to rely on rides from his mother.
I work really hard, but I sometimes feel like I don't deserve such a nice quality of life, and I'm not sure how long this will last.
The answer was 2 months. But when Braden lost one writing job, he quickly found another. That's what happens in emerging markets. Andrew Hubert is publisher of Chinasolved.com. He says the experiences for young workers in China come so fast and furious that they're equivalent to dog years.
China's moving beyond pure price competition, and now they are starting to focus more on services. So this does play to the strengths of young college graduates who can write, can do service jobs, and run small teams of people.
But for Americans of a certain age, over 40, moving to Shanghai means avoiding the unemployment line. Ken Grady moved here 2 years ago to head up an engineering team at an automotive parts company. He says work as a manager back in the States is depressing, emotionally, as well as economically.
Here in China, I spend 20-30% of my time hiring new people. And in the U.S., I'd probably spend 70% of my time trying to figure out how to get rid of people or how to reduce cost in some way.
So, as long as the American economy keeps going south, more Americans will keep coming east. In Shanghai, I'm Bill Marcus for Marketplace.
Coming up, new pricing and new tastes in the wine world.
Say if they used to enjoy a Sancerre for 20 and now their favorite producer is 25, they're going to look for a comparable producer in that same price range that they originally purchased.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow rose 70 points today, nearly 0.6% to 12,280. The S&P 500 edged up a point, 1361 is the number. But the NASDAQ lost 15 points, 0.6% to 2459. Whispers of the two I words, inflation and interest rates, took a toll on the financial sector today. Washington Mutual plummeted 17% over the usual suspect. That would be greater than expected exposure to mortgage-related losses. Fannie Mae slipped 2%. Financial managers worried aloud about the inflation pressures, and that inevitably leads to the next question. When might the Fed raise rates? The short answer is, yeah, we don't know. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4% even. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on the April trade balance. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee continues its series of hearings on the U.S. credit markets. And the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security discusses gangs, what's effective and what's not. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You say tomato, I say tomato. Today, McDonald's decided to call the whole thing off. Retailers and restaurants have stopped serving and selling certain varieties of tomatoes. Red Roma, red plum, and round red tomatoes are suspected in a salmonella outbreak that has spread to 16 states so far. Nobody's sure exactly where the bacteria came from or how to stop it, which for some in the produce business sounds distressingly familiar. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
More than a few of us have had a nasty experience with salmonella. The bacteria is usually associated with meat, raw eggs, or mayonnaise. Professor Francisco Diaz at the University of Minnesota says over the past few decades, it's been showing up in veggies.
The salmonella is present in the gastrointestinal tract of animals.
Yum. That means the tomatoes could have been contaminated by manure or from tainted irrigation water. That's how E. coli got into spinach in 2006. The outbreak cost spinach growers more than $100 million. Diaz says officials don't know the source of the salmonella. Produce these days comes from all over the globe. Each farm uses different irrigation and hygiene practices.
The source could be many, but in this particular outbreak, it's too early to tell where it actually come from.
The salmonella is so widespread that the Food and Drug Administration is only identifying those states and countries that have not been associated with it. Last year's U.S. field-grown tomato crop was worth $1.3 billion. Farmers are losing millions each day. Even in states like California that have the all-clear, consumers probably won't buy tomatoes, but they may grow their own. Linda Sapp runs the Tomato Growers Supply Company. The Florida business sells seeds. She says her orders are growing like dandelions.
Today we had twice as many as we had on this Monday in 2007.
I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
If your supermarket's anything like mine, it's got an entire aisle devoted exclusively to water. Now, maybe I live in a very water-conscious neighborhood, I don't know, but I don't think that's the case, because bottled water is a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry. But why? Why do so many of us pay so much for something we can literally get almost for free? That's the question Elizabeth Royd set out to answer in her latest book, Bottle Mania. Elizabeth, good to have you with us.
Hi there.
So let's get the first question out of the way right up front. Is bottled water necessarily better for us?
I wish I had a really straight, simple answer for you.
I was hoping you would.
Water is a really local and individual issue, and in general, I would say that bottled water is no better or worse for you than tap water. Bottled water has basically the same level of contaminants, things in it, that tap water does and that the government allows to be in it. Bottled water is much less inspected than tap water, so that is one big difference.
I can get water out of my tap in my kitchen for a couple of bucks per thousand gallons, right?
The national average is about $2.50 for 1,000.
Was that you taking a sip of water in the middle of this water interview?
Yeah, sorry, I'm thirsty.
All right, let's...
I'm sipping tap water.
but that's good then, and that goes to the question. I can turn on my tap and get, 1,000 gallons for a couple of bucks. Why then are people in this country and all over the world willing to pay so much on a relative scale for water that comes out of a bottle?
I think people are willing to pay more because they think that the water in the bottle is better. It took off because of very clever marketing that preyed on our ideas about health and wellness and beauty and weight loss and things like that. And we were told that we needed to hydrate, and drink 8-ounce glasses a day. And so portability became really important. And that marketing worked really, really well. It turned bottled water into a $115 million a year industry in 1990 to a $11.5 billion a year industry in 2007.
Back when I was a kid, the bottled water, and there really was only one, was Perrier, right? In the pear-shaped green bottle, and it was all the rage. Did it all start there?
Well, bottled water has been around for many centuries, but essentially the bottled water craze in this country, we can trace to that. It was 1977 when Perrier was introduced, and it was very much a niche product at first. Yuppies drank it. It was an urban thing. Nobody was walking down the street with that pretty green glass bottle swigging it, but the water had a certain cachet. It was French. It had those great bubbles, and Orson Welles did the ads. And so that started us thinking about celebrity and status. And the big change actually isn't that dramatic. It was a technological innovation. In 1989, it became possible to put bottled water in bottles made of PET plastic, and that's the lightweight bottles. And all of a sudden, it became much easier and cheaper to put water into these bottles, and that's when the marketing, tens of millions of dollars were spent pushing the bottled water on us.
You make your feelings pretty clear through the course of this book about the relative merits of tap water versus bottled water. I guess what I'm wondering, though, is do you have any real hope that the bottled water trend is going to change?
Well, first, I want to say that my feelings changed over the course of the book. I wanted to find out how bottled water had become so popular, and I realized that you can't really get into that without knowing what was right or wrong about tap water. I think people really don't know anything about where their water comes from. People don't know whether they're drinking groundwater or surface water. They don't know what's in their watershed, and they just have a lot of questions about it, and they don't go and find out what's in there. And it's really easy to find, well, it's sort of easy to find out what is in your water. If you have any questions, test your water yourself. So shell out the money. I spent about $140. I ran all these tests, and it was very, I was relieved. I was really happy to find out that my water was perfectly healthy to drink. And as more people find out about the quality of their tap water, I think that they will stick with their tap water and fight to protect it.
The latest book from Elizabeth Royd is called Bottle Mania: How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
The beauty of covering business is that it's not always a zero-sum game. There are clear winners and losers sometimes, but the news is usually more nuanced than that. Currencies are a great example. As he was leaving this morning for a week in Europe, the president said official U.S. policy is to have a strong dollar. Of course, the dollar's pretty weak right now. It's the euro that's strong. And as currencies move, exports rise, imports fall, or maybe it's the other way around, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're standing on. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the story now of an industry that's feeling both the good and the bad.
We're walking now in between Cabernet Sauvignon vines.
Harvey Poser is leading me through a vineyard, or as he likes to call it, his front yard.
And with mountains on either side of us, I guess we are right in the heart of Napa Valley.
Exactly so. This is it. It's 30 miles long, and we're about 10 miles from the bay.
Posert has been in the wine business for 50 years. These days, he represents the wines of the late Robert Mondavi and his two sons, as well as those of Charles Shaw. We get to talking about the weakening dollar, and a smile comes across his face.
What's going on in the wine business?
Well, the wine business is good. Our exports have an advantage going overseas, and imports are at a disadvantage coming in. So all signs are rosy, or rosé, as we say.
Especially, he says, because much of America's main competition sells its wine in euros. When the euro goes up, all those European wines get more expensive at the same time. But things are not rosé for everyone in the business. For some, they're downright noir. About an hour south of Napa at the San Francisco Wine Trading Company, workers are boxing champagne for delivery. Employee Michelle Pepitone and owner Gary Marcoletti tell me European wines make up about 60% of their business, and they're getting more expensive by the day. That's leading some customers to adjust their habits.
Say if they used to enjoy a Sancerre for 20 and now their favorite producer is 25, they're going to look for a comparable producer in that same price range that they originally purchased.
So they have their price point and they know what they want to spend, but they're getting a different wine than they used to.
Yes, if the increase is significant.
In some cases, she says, that means a customer will drop that French Burgundy and go with a California Pinot. But in other cases, Marcoletti takes a smaller profit just to make a sale.
We've never seen this large of an increase over a period of, say, 5 years. We're talking, in some cases here, about 75% increase in the dollar being so weak.
Marcoletti could easily drown his sorrows over a nice bottle of Bordeaux with a French winemaker. Last year, the French saw a 3% drop in exports to the world's biggest wine customer, the United States. Wine industry analyst John Fredrickson says France's solution has been to allow the production of less expensive wine.
They're also finding other markets. They're aggressively going after big markets like the United Kingdom. Other new markets have emerged in Russia and in the Far East, so that everybody is outselling wines where they can to offset the slowdown in the U.S.
Fredrickson says those producing cheaper American wines are the export winners here. Some even ship in bulk and bottle overseas to cut costs. So I have to ask the big question. Are we the new Argentina of wine?
Well, not exactly. We're up against countries that have huge surpluses, and thus they can be very competitive even against our best offer.
Plus, analysts warn, don't pop the cork too soon. Just like in Argentina, a currency can rise just as fast as it can fall. In Napa Valley, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we let you go today. You know how gas at $4 has finally managed to change our behavior, getting us to drive less or be smarter about how we drive? The same thing might finally be happening in the airline business. In what could be a sign that all those surcharges and extra fees are taking their toll, a weekend fare increase hasn't stuck. Over the past 2 months, there have been 6 consecutive fare increases. But today, Continental blinked about its latest hike, $20 it imposed over the weekend. Analysts are saying it could be a sign of falling demand. Airlines do tend to move in packs on these things. So, you know, here's hoping. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 70 points, a half of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 15 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 bumped up a point. That's a fraction of 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, did you ever wonder what banks were thinking when they made those subprime loans? So did this guy.
We never understood why it made sense to make someone a loan so you would owe more in the home later than what you started with. That didn't seem sensible to us.
It's another conversation from the corner office tomorrow, this time with Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.